Right.
Good afternoon, comrades. Welcome to our fortnightly discussion hosted by the Consistent Democrats. Today we are studying Chapter 2 of State and Revolution, entitled Experience of 1848 to 1851. Ian is maybe going to talk for about 20, 30 minutes.
About half an hour.
And then we'll open it up for discussion, for questions and general discussion.
Okay,
Ian, take it away.
Okay, thank you. Right, yes, this is... can people hear me all right? Hello?
Yes, we can.
Yeah, okay. Yes. Checking because I'm getting some wobbly things on my internet. Anyway, okay, this is Chapter 2 of State and Revolution, the experience of 1848 to 51. And Lenin's work that we're using here is a major primer on the Marxist theory of the state. And it goes through various stages of the development of that theory pretty comprehensively. And in hindsight, it probably would have been better to have studied this before taking on Trotsky's The Revolution Betrayed, as that gives a grounding. This gives a grounding in some very basic Marxist concepts that are invaluable to understanding that later work. But this chapter makes a very clear start on what we're addressing here. Because in part one, Lenin talks of Marx and Engels' views on the state on the eve of the continental wide revolutionary crisis of 1848. And in particular, he hones in on Marx's formulations in his work called The Poverty of Philosophy, which was his initial polemic against Pierre Proudhon, who was a proto-anarchist thinker. And here he wrote about the destiny of class society to disappear. And he wrote this, he said, "The working class, in the course of development, will substitute for the old bourgeois society an association which will preclude classes and their antagonism, and there will be no more political power groups, since the political power is precisely the official expression of class antagonism in bourgeois society." So, the idea that the state will disappear as a consequence of a proletarian revolution is to be found in the earliest works of mature Marxism. And then he highlights the way in which this is Lenin, that is, he highlights the way that this is dealt with by Marx and Engels in the Communist Manifesto. And so he quotes the following passage, which I think is quite useful. It says, "In depicting the most general phases of the development of the proletariat, we traced the more or less veiled civil war raging within existing society up to the point that where that war breaks out into open revolution, and where the violent overthrow of the bourgeoisie lays the foundation for the sway of the proletariat. We have seen above that the first step in the revolution by the working class is to raise the proletariat to the position of the ruling class to win the battle of democracy. And the proletariat will use its political supremacy to wrest, by degrees, all capital from the bourgeoisie, to centralise all instruments of production in the hands of the state, i.e. of the proletariat organised as the ruling class, and to increase the total productive forces as rapidly as possible." And it's that formulation that the state after the revolution will be the proletariat, in quotes, the proletariat organised as the ruling class, that had been, not accidentally, omitted in all the various treatises and theses on the state and socialism in the Second International. So Lenin says this, he says, "The definition of the state has never been explained in the prevailing propaganda and agitation literature of the official social democratic parties, More than that, it has been deliberately ignored, for it is absolutely irreconcilable with reformism, and it's a slap in the face for the common opportunist prejudices and Philistine illusions about the peaceful development of democracy. It says the proletariat needs the state. This is repeated by all the opportunists, social chauvinists and Kautskyites who assure us that this is what Marx taught. But then Lenin clarifies, he says, but they forget to add that in the first place, according to Marx, the proletariat needs only a state which is withering away, i.e. a state so constituted that it begins to wither away immediately and cannot but wither away. And secondly, the working people need a state, i.e. the proletariat organised as the ruling class. So what's this about? The state, as we touched on in chapter 1, is a special organisation of force for the suppression of one class by another. What class must the proletariat in power suppress? Obviously, the bourgeoisie. But in what way? Lenin says this. He says, the exploiting classes need political rule to maintain exploitation, i.e. in the selfish interests of an insignificant minority against the vast majority of all people. The exploited classes need political rule in order to completely abolish all exploitation, i.e. in the interests of the vast majority of the people, and against the insignificant minority consisted of the modern slave owners, the landowners and capitalists. And Lenin points out that the Social Democrats did away with this with dreams of class harmony, pictured their version of socialism as the peaceful submission of the minority to the majority. And Lenin called this a petty bourgeois utopia and pointed out that it led to socialist, in quotes, participation in bourgeois cabinets in Britain, in France and in Italy at the turn of the century. And he speaks of the role of the working class in leading intermediate layers. So he says, only the proletariat, by virtue of the economic role that it plays in large-scale production, is capable of being the leader of all the working and exploited people, whom the bourgeoisie exploit, oppress and crush, often not less than more than they do the proletarians, but who are incapable of waging an independent struggle for their emancipation. And he summarises the issue in this way. He says, Marx's theory of the state, i.e. the state the proletariat organises the ruling class, is inseparably bound up with the whole of his doctrine of the revolutionary role of the proletariat in history. The culmination of this rule is the dictatorship of the proletarian dictatorship, the political rule of the proletariat. And he goes on, he asks the question, is it conceivable that such an organisation can be created without first abolishing, or destroying that is, the state machine created by the bourgeoisie for themselves? And that leads straight to the conclusions that Marx drew from 1848 to 51, from the revolutions. Lenin cites Marx's later work called The 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte. He notes Napoleon III's coup of December 1951. And Marx wrote then, he wrote, the executive power with its enormous bureaucratic and military organisation, this appalling parasitic body which enmeshes the body of French society and chokes all its pores, sprang up in the days of the absolute monarchy with the decay of the feudal system which it helped to hasten. The first French Revolution developed centralisation, but at the same time, it increased the extent, the attributes and the number of agents of governmental power. Napoleon I completed this state machinery. The parliamentary Republic found itself compelled to strengthen, along with repressive measures, the resources and centralisation of governmental power. And then he quotes a conclusion that Marx and Engels actually drew from that, or Marx actually drew from that. And he simply said, all previous revolutions perfected this machine instead of smashing it. And Lenin notes here that Marxism takes a tremendous step forward compared with the Communist Manifesto. All previous revolutions perfected the state machine, whereas it must be broken or smashed. And he says, this is the question Marx raises and answers in 1852. True to his philosophy of dialectical materialism, Marx takes as his basis the historical experience of the great years of revolution, 1848 to 1851. And here, as everywhere else, his theory is a summing up of experience, illuminated by a profound philosophical conception of the world and a rich knowledge of history. So that brings us to the three-cornered polemic against reformism and centrism on the one hand, and anarchism on the other hand, which recurs in this work, and it will keep uprising as we study it. But talking about that, Lenin says this. He says, the bureaucracy and standing army are a parasite on the body of bourgeois society, a parasite created by the internal antagonisms which rend that society, but a parasite which chokes all its vital pores. The Kautskyite opportunism now prevailing in official social democracy considers the view that the state is a parasitic organism to be the peculiar and exclusive attribute of anarchism. It goes without saying that this distortion of Marxism is a vast advantage to those Philistines who have reduced socialism to the unheard-of disgrace of justifying and prettifying the imperialist war by applying to it the concept of defence of the fatherland. And he notes what happened after the Russian Revolution of February 1917 in that regard. He says this, consider what happened in Russia during the 6 months following February the 27th, 1917. The official posts which were formerly given by preference to the Black Hundreds have now become the spoils of the Cadets, the Mensheviks and social revolutionaries. No one's really thought about introducing any serious reforms. Every effort has been made to put them off until the Constituent Assembly meets and to steadily put off its convocation until after the war. But there's been no delay, no waiting for the Constituent Assembly in the matter of dividing the spoils of getting the lucrative jobs of ministers, deputy ministers, governors general, etc., etc. Which leads Lenin to the conclusion that's similar, but on a much higher historical plane to what Marx and Engels had discovered in 1848. And he says this, the more the bureaucratic apparatus is redistributed, that is, among the various bourgeois and petty bourgeois parties, among the cadets, the social revolutionaries and Mensheviks in the case of Russia, the more keenly aware the oppressed classes and the proletariat at their head become of the irreconcilable hostility of the whole of bourgeois society. This course of events compels the revolution to concentrate all its forces of destruction against the state power and to set itself the aim not of improving the state machine, but of smashing and destroying it. And then he turns to the question of what the working class will put in the place of this state machine. He touches on that, but it will be explored more in later chapters. He asks the question, what will the proletariat put in its place is suggested. Well, he suggests this, he doesn't really ask a question. He says, what the proletariat will put in its place is suggested by the highly instructive material furnished by the Paris Commune. And really, we're getting to the end of this. One final point regarding this is Lenin's expansion, emphasis on expansion, of a point that Marx himself made about his own distinctive contribution to politics. And so Lenin quotes Marx here. He quotes him as saying this. He says, "And now, as to myself, no credit is due to me for discovering the existence of classes in modern society or the struggle between them. Long before me, bourgeois historians had described the historical development of this class struggle, and bourgeois economists, the economic anatomy of classes. What I did was new was to prove, one, that the existence of classes is bound up only with the particular historical phases in the development of production, and two, that the class struggle necessarily leads to the dictatorship of the proletariat, and three, that this dictatorship itself only constitutes the transition to the abolition of all classes and to a classless society." And Lenin expands on that in a devastating criticism of opportunism, of both reformist and centrist opportunism, when he writes the following. He said, "It's often said and written that the main point in Marx's theory is the class struggle. But this is wrong, and this wrong notion very often results in an opportunist distortion of Marxism and its falsification in a spirit acceptable to the bourgeoisie. For the theory of the class struggle was created not by Marx, but by the bourgeoisie before Marx, and generally speaking, it's acceptable to the bourgeoisie. Only he is a Marxist who extends the recognition of the class struggle to the recognition of the dictatorship of the proletariat. That is what constitutes the most profound distinction between the Marxist and the ordinary petty, as well as big, bourgeois. This is the touchstone on which the real understanding and recognition of Marxism should be tested, and it's not surprising that when the history of Europe brought the working class face to face with this question as a practical issue, not only all the opportunists and reformists, but all the Kautskyites, that is, people who vacillate between reformism and Marxism, proved to be miserable Philistines and petty bourgeois democrats repudiating the dictatorship of the proletariat." And so, just to conclude matters as regards this chapter, I'll just quote Lenin a little bit more. He continues on this vein. And he says, "Further, the essence of Marx's theory of the state has been mastered only by those who realise that the dictatorship of a single class is necessary not only for every class society in general, not only for the proletariat which has overthrown the bourgeoisie, but also for the entire historical period which separates capitalism from classless society, i.e. from communism. Bourgeois states are the most varied in form, but their essence is the same. All these states, whatever their form, in the final analysis, are invariably the dictatorship of the bourgeoisie. The transition from capitalism to communism is certainly bound to a tremendous abundance and variety of political forms, but the essence will inevitably be the same, the dictatorship of the proletariat." And actually, just to conclude my own little ad lib, I mean, I think that actually is, has some relevance to The Revolution Betrayed and what I said at the beginning of this talk, that it would have been good to study this before we studied The Revolution Betrayed, because that is about some of the many variants of the dictatorship of the proletariat that revealed themselves in real life later. But anyway, I mean, that's a good introduction to Lenin's the second chapter of Lenin's State and Revolution, which in turn is an introduction to the succeeding chapters, which are all about, you know, going into the state, in the question of the state and the Marxist attitude to it in considerably more depth. So I'll leave it there and open it up for discussion. Thank you, comrades.
Okay, thank Ian, comrades. Please indicate if you wish to speak. Those on camera, you can just use your real hand and I'll be able to see you. Those aren't on camera, where possible, please could you use your virtual hand and then I'll call you to speak. And obviously, please try and keep it to one at a time. So who wishes to speak now? I'll say something if I may, if no one else is going to come in. I did find it interesting how Lenin, or perhaps Marx even, took it upon themselves to attack elements of the petty bourgeoisie where they could be accused of being idealists by pretending that elements of the bourgeoisie would suddenly develop a conscience, and they will give up the power that they have, and obviously Lenin and Marx obviously thought that was nonsense, and I happen to agree with them on that. I think in the end, they will inevitably need to be forced. It doesn't, I mean, those individuals might not be evil per se, but they are defending their own class position, aren't they? So when push comes to shove, they are going to be forced. They are going to need to be forced to give up what they have. Yeah, I just wanted to make that point. I hope others will come in eventually.
I see there's some questions in the chat about what I was quoting from. Well, I was quoting from chapter 2 of The Revolution Betrayed. I mean, I went through the three sections of it. And obviously, you can't just read the whole thing out. You have to select what's appropriate for a presentation, which is what I did. But they're all fragments of that, which hopefully make a coherent talk. Hopefully make something we can discuss. That's all I can say about it, really, without going through it in great depth. I haven't got the text in front of me, not the whole.
I mean, ideally, Conway could have read it before, but if they haven't, it might encourage you to read it afterwards and gain some understanding from it afterwards if you haven't already.
I did circulate this by email, but I'm not really sure I circulated it to everybody, so that's unfortunate.
Mark and then Susan.
Yeah, just to reassure you, Paul and Ian, that I was actually reading my copy with Ian. I was actually reading the chapter, so it makes a lot of sense to me now.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all, to me, it's all common sense stuff about the structures and the capitulations, etc. So I don't really have any question because a lot of it to me is self-explanatory. So thanks.
Susan.
Yeah. The only thing I was going to say is I can see why people continually try and learn from the past, because it is uncannily similar. You know, Napoleon trying to invade Russia because it attacking its so-called, its supposed friend, ally, for being unwilling to blockade the British and not being sufficiently compliant with Napoleon's wishes, which is very like Trump and Biden, threatening China, Russia in order to get at China, threatening Europe with sanctions in order to ensure that the blockade works, when in reality, Russia is just too big to be able to blockade successfully. And you just end up authoring your own demise. But I think a lot of the stuff that is talking about, the demise of the ruling class, or even when it's pushed out by, the combination of working, the agricultural workers and the industrial workers, as was in Russia, will still not, it will still be faced with a bunch of, globalist capitalists who invaded Russia after that revolution. And he doesn't have any, although Trotsky is interesting for his belief that people will eventually have to get rid of the working class, which makes them, I think, reluctant to say, well, is it really worth it because of all this pain? At the end of the day, we're faced with a very different problem now, which is that technology may well get rid of the working class altogether, and that, robots and AI may actually allow the globalists, the very, very few, the 1%, create the world they want without the need for either the working class nor the bureaucracy. And is there anything further on that actually deals with that, Ian?
Mark got his hand up, so can we take Mark in before we bring Ian in? Mark, go ahead. Mark A, sorry. You muted, Mark.
Sorry, Paul. Yeah, unfortunately, it doesn't follow on from what Susan's just been saying. I'll make this quick. I just got a query about who Karl Kautsky was. Was he a former Marxist who became a social democrat and sold out, or what? Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks, Mark. Ian.
Shall I come back on that then? First of all, on Mark's question, Karl Kautsky was probably the most eminent Marxist after Marx in the Second International, after Marx and Engels. But he was soft. He wasn't really an orthodox Marxist. And he became Lenin's great antagonist because he was a centri- he was sort of like the prototype of a centrist, someone who was revolutionary in words, reformist in deeds. So he was, the SPD became a parliamentary party, and it became, it's the main theoretically Marxist party of the Second International. Unlike the British Labour Party, of course, which was run by Fabians and people who had no Marxist understanding at all, the German Social Democracy was run, initially by people like August Bebel, and Wilhelm Liebknecht, who were actually Wilhelm Liebknecht was the father of Karl Liebknecht, who died in the German Revolution in 1919. He was killed, was murdered by the German high command or whatever. But they were Orthodox Marxists. They were serious people. Kautsky was a little bit later than the first generation of German Marxists. But he became the most eminent of the leaders of the SPD. There was sort of in the 20 in the early, the 1900s, up to the outbreak of the war. But in the war, he took a, the German SPD, actually, it betrayed its whole tradition. It voted for the war, and it basically herded millions of German workers into the trenches to fight against the British and the French and the Russians, when its whole programme before the war was it should have opposed it should have fought against it in a revolutionary manner. and it completely failed to do so. And Kautsky's policy was to keep, although he was somewhat critical of the war, it was to keep the unity of the party, and the unity of the party was above all everything. So he basically became the antagonist of those who wanted to create a new party and the New International. And Lenin wrote a pamphlet called The Proletarian Revolution and the Renegade Kautsky that's extremely sharp against him, and basically says he's a traitor to communism, to socialism, whatever, in a very sharp manner, so which I think is correct. You know, because Kautsky was the opponent of the revolutionary opposition to the war. He was the most sophisticated opponent. He wasn't just a crude chauvinist. He was someone who produced elaborate theoretical and explanations about why there shouldn't be a new party and a new international, and there shouldn't be a revolutionary struggle against the war. That's why Kautsky is treated so sharply in this pamphlet and other pamphlets of Lenin's, you know, just to answer that question. Regarding Susan's point about, you know, that capitalism will abolish the proletariat, effectively, that seems to be what you're saying. I don't think that's really possible, because capitalism will collapse if that happens. Because the driving force of capitalism, the thing that makes it go, is the profit motive. And all surplus value in the end comes from human labour, from human labour power. And what they've been doing actually is exporting jobs from the advanced countries, because workers in the United States and Britain have become, you know, have become relatively too expensive to pay, because what you have is the falling rate of profit. There's a tendency over a long period of time under capitalism for the rate of profit to gradually fall. And of course, workers who've won social gains, who've fought battles for many, many years to improve their standard of living, they've increased the relative value of labour power at the same time. And then there comes a point where the bourgeoisie can no longer make enough profits to keep its system going. And in the 70s, they changed their strategy. And they started to, instead of fight the working class on the industrial front in the advanced countries, and it tries to inflict defeats on it like Britain did happened in Britain in the 20s and 30s, what they started to do was export the jobs themselves to low-wage countries. And they could do this with computer technology as an aid and things like this, you know. And so that's what neoliberalism was, a new strategy. They saw it as the way to save their system. Ironically, they exported lots of jobs to places like China and India. And of course, it helped China to industrialise and become a major competitor. And as a worker, remaining a deformed workers' state, it strengthened China in a way that they didn't completely expect. Because China is a deformed workers' state, yes. And it allowed China to take advantage of this imperialist neoliberal program and industrialise their country and produce a very potent competitor indeed, which is on the verge of outpacing the West and the imperialist West in terms of its technology. And the fact that it has a somewhat, it's not a socialist regime, but not, that would be a vulgar way of putting it, but it has an element of post-capitalist, sort of social nature, was allowed it to develop technology even faster than the West. Once it got that impetus from Western exports of labour, not labour, of capital, to employ their labour to try and raise the rate of profit in the West. They've succeeded in deindustrializing the West and industrializing China, and some other countries as well have become more industrialized. But particularly China has become a potent competitor. And they're really hysterical about it, as we all know. It's the hysteria about China and Russia as well, which is a slightly different case, but there are some elements of that involved in that as well, you know. So I don't think capitalism can survive without surplus value, without its ability to generate surplus value. And if AI replaces all human labour, then there'll be no surplus value because it's just capital expenditure, isn't it? So where's the profit going to come from? The whole thing goes, and that's the problem. You know, it's a built-in contradiction that, I mean, might lead to the whole total economic collapse. You know, that's a possibility. We don't really know, but if it becomes impossible to realise surplus value, then logically the system will collapse and it will have to be replaced by something else. Otherwise, the whole world collapse into barbarism, and that is the historic choice, isn't it? Socialism or barbarism? Yeah. I'll leave it there. Susan wants to come and speak again.
It was just to say, I think you've got slightly the wrong thing about what I was aiming at, but yeah, I do agree. Capitalism is driving itself into destruction because the more that it tries to grind out more profit, it's the law of diminishing returns. Mm-hmm. That they think that they can own everything. They're doing a sleight of hand with, quite honestly, the AI bubble, which certainly China and Russia seem to be advancing on a much cheaper version of AI. And I do think that the globalist capitalists are deliberately stoking it because I suspect they're ferreting their money away in crypto and other things. Mm. But what I am saying is, for the first time, the workers and the working class are facing an enemy in the billionaires who, thanks to this mad thing about, transhumanism and so on, actually seem to think that they could survive a world without workers, while busy organ trafficking and sex trafficking and God knows what, to satisfy a bunch of people who basically are populist politicians in order to keep the system going. But what we are looking at is a parallel system which appears to be, neither worker state, as you say. But the interesting thing is it's led by Russia and China, who have been through communist revolutions, who have been through a system where humans retain their value as people, which is something that the capitalist, mantra is that you can equate labor with money, that money works, whereas, of course, money doesn't. It's the privilege of access to credit and debt slavery that works. Yeah. And what I'm asking is, Trotsky in that chapter mentions eventually the replacement of the working class. I'm asking, what does he see a time when people will, have to work less but get more of the rewards?
Oh, yes.
Or does he see a time when there won't be a need for workers, but there will be leisure?
I'll just come back on that. I mean,
that's what I'm asking. Sorry, I didn't frame it that well.
This is Lenin, not Trotsky, actually.
It's Lenin, sorry.
But I know what you mean. Yes, I mean, of course he does. He's talking about, later in the book, he starts talking about communism, the higher and the lower stage of communism. And we will get onto that, and it goes into it in some depth and detail. And yes, I mean, we will see that the proletariat abolishes itself, but because it abolishes itself as an oppressed class, and you simply have a class of society at the higher stage of communism, where you don't actually need compulsion to make people work. Work becomes simply, it becomes what humanity collectively needs to do to actually carry on with its existence, and does so in a non-antagonistic manner. It ceases to be necessary to force people to work because, working to a degree is what makes you human, in a non-class society, That is part of the vision of communism, and it's not a utopian vision at all. It's based on an extrapolation of the possibilities of that exist in modern society, even in the days of Marx and Engels and Lenin. It was visible that this could be done, you know, that this is the logical culmination of industrial society, of the increase of the standard of living of populations resulting from industrialization and from technology, in other words. It could lay the basis for a human society that is truly human, and which those technologies are used to serve humanity in a collective manner. But what you have at the moment is that those technologies are used to enslave and brutalize and exploit the working class, and that continues even under some of the most sophisticated technologies capitalism has produced, including AI. And computer technology in general, which is being used as a means of keeping the ruling class in power instead of what it should be used for, which is to serve humanity and to give us an easier life, you know. So, the question is really, what are they capable of escaping from capitalism altogether? Is something else able to come along and replace it that's not socialism? I suppose that's the implication of what you're saying. And the answer is, I don't really know. I don't think anybody knows that. But I don't think they can bank on living, you know, unscathed if they destroy the rest of humanity. I really, you know, I think that there is a possibility that the bourgeoisie will destroy humanity itself in various ways. But if they do, they're not going to survive. They're going to be, you know, they will go one way, not necessarily at exactly the same time, but they will go. You know, they can live in their nuclear bunker for a while, but in the end, they're fucked, aren't they? You know, that's how I see it. You know, or the utopian world of sex trafficking and God knows what. You know, in the end, it's a reactionary utopia, and it ain't gonna work, Paul. Sorry, I'm not sharing.
Yeah, on the business of AI, personally, I think the ruling class overestimate the speed at which it develops. Because you might find that when people start using it, it wasn't quite developed as the company that made the AI. It wasn't quite as developed as they'd hoped, and then they have to go back to the drawing board and move programmers and so on. But at the same time, the amount of programmers that you have within the working class could also allow you to basically create your own AI for ourselves. I don't think AI necessarily is a bad thing. It's the class of people that's using it that's the issue, and what they want to use it for. But if the working class could somehow subvert it and use it for our own people, then, as you say, AI could actually be used as a tool to give us all an easier life. And for people like me that has a disability, and there will be others, I'm sure, who actually could actually benefit from elements of AI. So I get the environmental argument, and I understand that we're not the people that make the key decisions about what we want it to be used for, but we could develop our own forms of AI and use it in the way that we want it. And that sort of thing. As Marx said himself in the Communist Manifesto, the bourgeoisie also developed its own tools for its own destruction at the same time. And I see with AI, that's also another possibility. I think along the way, there will always we suddenly became an input with AI because somebody has still got to make the decisions about what a program does and what it doesn't do. So, yeah, I don't see AI doing away with workers in the way that some people envisage. I think people are far overestimating the pace at which it actually develops in practice. Thanks, Jonathan.
Can you switch the light on?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think, again, we come back to this point that I've made before, that we've got to be careful about coming to hasty conclusions about what the epoch we're living in, what it means, because we've been so wrong before about developments. It's very difficult to tell, and it's difficult to tell what it will look like in 30 years' time. I mean nobody I know, I mean, predicted the rise of China and that sort of thing, and in the late 80s, they were talking about that Japan was going to challenge American imperialism, that there was a serious possibility that it would. So, you know, all the speculation is very, it's very difficult in the period you're living in to say what the effects of AI and what the, you know, and what the developments that are happening now will have. And, you know, there's just a thing of caution about it all. I mean, you know, the state, as the question of Lenin and the state, I mean, I didn't do the reading, I didn't have the time, but I, you know, I mean, Lenin, there are loads of questions, and I'm sure there's a load of literature that's been written about the role of the state since the, you know, Lenin was, this was written in 1917, you know, and a lot of Marxist thought has developed then, and I'm not aware of what the debates are with the state, you know. One thing that sort of interests me, not only about capital and about the state, but about capital, is that within capitalism, there's what you call ungoverned spaces of society where the capitalists are not really interested in. They're not really interested in certain aspects of the way things are developing. They you know, it the state isn't all, and capital isn't all encompassing. And there are ungoverned spaces within the system which make when analysing the state and capital, it makes it quite difficult to nail it down, to sort of say what the state where the state intervenes and where it doesn't, and where capital intervenes and it doesn't. And I'm sure there's a load of literature being released on that I'm not aware of. I haven't read it.
Ian, do you want to come back on that before I bring Max in?
No, carry on.
Okay, go ahead, Max.
Okay. Yeah, I don't think... DI said as a software... Can you hear me?
Yeah.
As a software engineer, she's no danger of workers, whatever you said, no danger of working people disappearing or something like that. But was that the same person who said earlier somebody, I don't know who it was, that brought this whole up idea of the workers, you know, just getting rid of the working class. Or actually, what you're really talking about is the need for workers. That's what they're going to get rid of. And actually, to get rid of the, you know, the majority of mankind is a whole other level of science fiction. That, yeah, maybe that if things get bad enough, that'll happen. But I don't think that's like an Elon Musk fantasy or something. I don't think we're really there yet. Although I can tell just how my computers work. I mean, just in the last few years, the technology does have an element of future shock to it. Like, how does my phone know that I'm sitting in front of Burger King? You know, it's a little scary, but you know, it's not like the robots are taking over. I think we have to have some faith in the masses and not get too afraid of all this stuff. But it is kind of unnerving when I see that the stock market went up because they're investing all this stuff in some AI technology that they don't even, like, even the capitalists don't know. They have faith in something that they don't even know how it's going to work. I imagine, but I don't know if that's the reason for that, is that they think they can actually do away with workers or the need for workers, unless they have some diabolical secret scheme to wipe out all of humanity or something. I don't know. Maybe it's not beyond the possibility of what's happening, but I don't think we should, even if it is, I don't think they could pull it off. There's just too many people, although they are doing a lot of genocide. But anyway, beyond that, I forgot what I lost my train of thought. Oh, beyond that, I think we have to have some confidence in, just daily life. You know, you can't, yeah, they can make the factories work, but, you know, workers are everywhere. They have driverless cars. I was a cab driver for a long time. You know, you can't, these things don't work. They have these driverless cars and they're crashing into trains. It's not, you know, don't give them too much credit is what I'm saying. You have to have some faith in the masses, even if they're not organized back in the historical way that we were in the 30s and the times of the revolutions. You know, the revolution's gonna have a different feel to it, but it's still all about production and profit, no matter how. You know what I mean? That's what I had to actually internalize this myself to try to translate, like, profits in industries that aren't really industries, like, I don't know, for example, hospitality or, you know, these things where it's not obvious. The surplus value isn't obvious in the as it is in a factory. You know what I mean? But if you analyze it, it is. It's all about profit. And I think we give the capitalists too much credit because I think they're scared to death. And that's why they're preemptively, you know, censoring our rights and doing the slaughter in Gaza. So in a way, it's like there's the worse, the more horrible and depraved that they are, even though that's horrible, it also gives us hope because it shows how it's a good argument for the masses. It's like, it just shows how desperate they are. You know, they can't proceed in an orderly manner historically. It's like, you know, that's like that quote from Trotsky back in the 30s, where he says, oh, not only are we ripe for socialism, but it's already gone rotten. Well, now here we are 100 years later. Imagine how rotten it is. So when you talk about, somebody was talking about, well, it's hard to figure out where we are when we're living in it. I think that's, we have to realize it's become so clear that once the real problem is figuring out the leadership and organizing the masses to take power. And that's why I say we have to not just focus on workers, but workers in the military and in these things, you know, soldiers and stuff, because, you know, there's a lot of opposition you see in the United States from all sorts of people that aren't really socialists, but if we win them over, that are like against like Trump, like people like all these kind of libertarian, we can win over a lot of people, even MAGA people, you know. they're just frustrated workers. Anyway, I don't want to go on and on, but you get the idea.
Thanks, Matt. Ian, do you want to come in on those points?
To a degree. I mean, I'm not got a great deal to add. I think you know, yeah. I think capitalism. I don't think they've got some wonderful scheme of being able to escape from social reality. I think that's not true. You know, I think that people like Musk are indeed deluded. And they think they can. They think they're like supermen, you know, and they very much aren't. You know, they're pathetic. I mean, the guy who's just been awarded a 1 million a 1 trillion remuneration for his supposed work, but it's bollocks. It really is. It's megalomania. It's absurd, and. It's, you know, it's not even based on any real figures on any, you know, where's the money coming from? That's a very good question, actually. Where is the money coming from? It's coming from scams in things like crypto is a scam, in my opinion. You know, I have done a little bit of dabbling in it myself for a little while, just to see what was involved. But I do think it's a scam. It's crystallized. You know, it's. Another financial, you know, wheeze that makes money out of the what's behind it is an extravagant use of energy, you know, in part. And I think it is a scam. I think it's something that will come crashing down at some point, and it will, you know, whether AI is a scam. I don't think AI is a scam. I think there is a bubble in AI, and it's because people are saying it resembles the dot-com boom in 25 years ago, when you had these dot-coms, these companies that were so splendiferously new, and they were going to make all this money and all this sort of thing, and then there was this big the bubble popped sometime in 2000. You could slightly confuse that with the question of the 2000 millennium bug and everything, but I think they were somewhat related. And it all popped, and there was quite a considerable crash in financial markets because of the popping of the dot-com boom. You know, and I think there probably will be a popping of an AI boom, but AI will not disappear. It will probably become more refined and. It will replace some jobs, but it will create others. And that's why the bourgeoisie is, you know, sections of the bourgeoisie are enthused about it, because it will create other requirements. It'll create opportunities for to make more money and to generate surplus value in other ways. That's what they reckon, you know. I mean, they don't necessarily see it that way. They see it as making profits. But in fact, it's profits come from surplus value. And they invest in other forms of labour, superintending AI, or something, you know, because the thing is not omnipotent, is it? I don't think it's on the level that it can become omnipotent at the moment. I think that's science fiction. That really is Terminator 2 and all that sort of thing. I think we're not there, and I think the stuff we've got at the moment is a bit dumb, to be honest. Having dabbled with it recently. I've started to realise that it's not very clever, actually. But we shall see. You know, I don't think it's a panacea for capitalism, put it that way. You know, but I mean, I think the relevance of this stuff is of this material. Actually, I've actually paraphrased it in a leaflet we're going to use for the new party that's being created in Liverpool next weekend. You know, there's a conference. We've actually got a leaflet that paraphrases some of the stuff in State and Revolution about the need to the whole stuff about, you know, that we do not want parliamentary or official representatives who are being paid extravagant wages. We want people to be paid the rate of the of skilled workers and things like this, you know. We don't want, we want, you know, explicitly stating that the state is not something that working class representatives should be there to make money out of. It's there, it's there, it's basically we need to smash the state, you know. And making those points in hopefully a fairly comprehensible way to socialist militants in the Corbyn Sultana party as it's emerged, although it's pretty fraught and factionalised, I think is a useful thing to do, because I think this party, although it's got lots of problems, is probably the best opportunity we're likely to get to implant, you know, Marxist ideas in a mass movement. And I think it will. I think in some ways it already is a mass movement. If you get the sense of what's going on around the country, around Britain, that is, considerably sizable meetings going on in all sorts of different localities to actually get this thing off the ground. You know, I think it is a mass movement, even though there are the people at the top of it are at war with each other at the moment. And there is a discernible left wing and the right wing as well, which is something else that is in our favour, to be honest, because I think we need to take our position very much on the left wing of it and want to go further. Yeah. So yeah, I think this is not an abstract question. I think the question the stuff we're discussing now is something we want to inject into your party, the new party project, and actually make propaganda for communism in a fairly classical sense. That's what I think we're trying to do with this anyway. I'll leave it there for now. I think Max wants to speak anyway.
Matt, is that a legacy hand from your last question?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sorry. I don't know how to.
It's okay.
I know. I'll say something anyway, even though I forgot to. I'll say something anyway because we need to keep thinking about how. What vehicles? You know, I'm stuck with this Deleonist ideas that I started my socialist mind with as a child or a young person when my father was a Deleonist, because I used to read the pamphlets and this idea of having some kind of vehicle for economic control and then also the leading Trotskyist party. I have this melding of these ideas in my head that I never see anywhere in the groups that I've been in contact with over the years. It's a very rare thing where you find a Deleonist in a Trotskyist meeting or a Trotskyist in a Deleonist meeting. Deleonism almost doesn't exist, is kind of what I'm saying. But there really was a force there. Just because it was kind of like the Leninism of the United States in the 1900s and teens, but then it didn't turn into a revolution as it did in Russia. Okay, so it didn't do that, but that doesn't mean the ideas were not correct, and they were actually kind of on the same wavelength of in terms of organizing more than just the ideological intellectual arguments, you know. And I always thought that was important, and that was what impressed me, was this idea of a vehicle, you know. Because this is where I see a lot of the Trotskyist organizations falling apart, and they, like the fact that only this group and a couple other groups in the Trotskyist left have the correct position on Ukraine, where millions of workers are being slaughtered for some bullshit imperialist project, and yeah, Gaza is terrible, but so is Ukraine, and it's just like. If we had the correct line, you know, and actually I shouldn't even criticize. That's why I'm here at this meeting. That's why I like this organization, because I see, you know, there's some alignment with some groups in South America. Well, now I don't know if you know, guys know I'm in Brazil now. Somebody said there's emancipation, trabalho, workers emancipation. That's not you're in, but that they're making alliances with quasi-Stalinist organizations because they're taking the correct position on Ukraine in terms of military support for Russia as a self-defense, you know, whereas most of the self-named, self-proclaimed Trotskyist groups whether it's the Grantites or this group or that group, or there's so many, are all taking the wrong position. People that 10 years ago I thought were, I was in line with, you know, stopped speaking to me when I took the line, and they said I was a Stalinist. You know, it's amazing what people say when you change your position. But anyway, this is connected to the other things I'm talking about. If we can't get the international, we have to do both. We have to get our national struggle and organizations in terms of like socialist industrial unions, SEMSTROs, or Soviets, or, you know, workers' organizations in line, also build the leadership. But we shouldn't be so sectarian. You see, this is what I found a lot, like with the old Spartacists, when I bring up the Leon, even back in the 80s, they would say, no, that's irrelevant, Max, don't talk about that. But it always stuck that it wasn't irrelevant. Anyway, I don't know if anybody here knows what I'm talking about, but it's not irrelevant. It's like we have to focus on how we can get power, you know, not just the revolution, but the road to revolution is kind of like, it's built on, you know what I mean? Like it's built on concrete steps. Anyway, it's a combination. I don't think Trotsky had it 100%, nor did De Leon, but if we put them all together, we can get a good guide. And also, anyway, whatever. Also, I get confused with a lot of this new verbiage on the left in the last few decades of neoliberalism. It's like, I'm not even sure what that means, because depending on whose mouth it's coming out of, you know, it means something else. I used to hear a lot of this stuff in DSA from AOC supporters, and anyway, that's a separate, that's not that important. That's just nomenclature.
Ian, do you want to come in on any of that before
Jonathan speak?
I was just touching on something Max said there about the Trotskyist groups and that, and he's right. I mean, what we must get over, and what I think, you know, hopefully the thing is that we will get over in time is, look, if some Trotskyist group or Stalinist group, in hindsight, gets the line right, and this has been a real thing in the British left, if it gets it right, you turn around and say they got it right. You know, you don't find all sorts of reasons to say why it was actually wrong. You know, and you know, maybe that is an advance we can make in the. Compared to my day when I became involved, you know, where every, you know, every, even if another group was wrong, then was right, then it, they were right because they were wrong, or, you know. So we've got to, you know, maybe that's one small advance we can make is to say in hindsight, okay, yeah, they were right, or they were more or less right, and you know, we were wrong, and you know, and be open to change our minds about things.
It did tickle me when you made the comment about they were right because they were wrong, or whatever, you know. Who else would you speak?
Well, I could come back briefly on that. I mean, I think that, yeah, Max is right. I mean, what our Brazilian comrades are doing is not that different from what we're doing, because we work with the New Communist Party and we go to meetings every week. The New Communist Party is it's a pro-Moscow split from the old British Communist Party. It's existed since 1977. And we organise... our group and the NCP are the backbone of International Ukraine Anti-Fascist Solidarity, which organises demonstrations on every few weeks about Ukraine. You know, not just in London, but also sometimes in Scotland and Birmingham and places like that. It has done. You know, we're not the only people Trotskyists involved in this. There are a few independents involved now, like in Scotland, etc. But of course, there's Marie in London as well for the Passardists, but she's only one person now. But we do work with Stalinists on specific areas of agreement, and I think that's the right thing to do. And I suspect the Brazilians are doing something similar. You know, they're very, very much likely to be doing so. You know, I know that they are. They have done. They've even unified with some group of ex-Stalinists a while ago, along with the Brazilian Workers' Power Group in Britain. You know, they had a three-way fusion a couple of years ago, you know, which formed something called the Communist Party. Then it changed its name back to something a bit more modest, i.e. Emancipation of Labour, which is the name of the Brazilian group now. You know, but yes, it's, you know, we will work with people. I mean, we actually the LCFI signed a thing called the World Anti-Imperialist Platform, which was, we tried to sign it, except that it was initiated by the CPGBML, which is the group around Harpal Bra, or the late Harpal Bra. It's now run by Jyoti and Ranjit Bra, I think, and some other people. But they are a group with an Indian heritage, but they are a Stalinist group, and they're a very hard Stalinist group as well. They initiated this World Anti-Imperialist Platform at the time of the Ukraine special military operation. And the founding document, you couldn't really fault it. There was nothing wrong with it, except for possibly one slight historical reference to socialism in the USSR. But apart from that, you couldn't actually... That was one phrase in a long document. The rest of it was pure class politics. We signed it. We said, we're going to endorse it. And they said, no, you're not, because you're Trotskyists. But we tried anyway. I mean, that's the point. You know, the sectarianism is not one-sided, unfortunately. And it's something that we have to struggle to overcome. But we do work very well with the NCP. We, you know, I addressed their meeting on the October Revolution on the 8th of November this year. I gave a speech to the to their open event at their headquarters on the to celebrate the October Revolution, which I thought was really good. In fact, we should publish that speech. You know, I've got it. I've circulated it, but I should publish it, I suppose. But I think it's worthwhile working with Stalinists when they will do so. Yeah.
Okay, who else wants to speak? Mark C, do you want to say anything? I'm aware you haven't spoken yet.
Oh, no, I'm fine, thanks, Paul. Carry on.
Sure.
Okay, who else wants to speak? Ian, do you want to come back on anything?
I don't really think so.
I'm just wondering whether to start to sum up now and then...
I can sum up, but I don't think there's much more to say. I mean, I think we've had a good discussion, and there's been no massive disagreements in terms of the subject matter, I don't think. I think we will. There's a lot more to dissect and a lot more to absorb. In there's another four chapters of this book, which we should think about, you know, perhaps different people doing the presentation, or at least having a think about maybe that might be possible, you know. But yeah, I mean, you know, I don't think we've had a good discussion, but I don't think we've really, you know, obviously we want to focus more on the content of the book, and I think as we go through the book, that, I mean, the questions regarding communism, the lower phase of communism, the higher phase of communism, all that stuff is gone through in considerable detail in this book, which I think is quite educational in that regard anyway, and it's good to get into it. So I think I'll
Can I make the closing remarks then? And
sure.
And then we'll turn off the recording.
Sure.
Okay, comrades. It's been a very good discussion. Thank you all for coming, and hopefully we'll see you hopefully in 2 weeks' time to discuss chapter 3 of State and Revolution. And so thank you for coming, and now we can click off the recording.